Shalom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Happy Christmas. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah.
Hanukkah's a man.
Fourth week of Advent. So we're covering all of our bases.
My 14th anniversary today.
Mazel tov. By connecting the incarnation with light. And so we will be looking at John chapter 1 to begin our time. And so if someone has already turned there, if we could go ahead and read, that would be wonderful. Who would like to volunteer?
Verses.
Keep going until I stop, please.
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through Him all things were made. Without Him nothing was made that has been made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. There came a man who was sent from God. His name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light, so that through Him all men might believe. He Himself was not the light. He came only as a witness to the light. The true light that gives light to every man was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through Him, the world did not recognize Him. He came to that which was His own, but His own did not receive Him. Yet to all who received Him, to those who believed in His name, He gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision, or a husband's will, but born of God. The Word became flesh and made His dwelling among us. We have seen His glory, the glory of the one and only, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. John testifies concerning Him. He cries out, saying, "This was He of whom I said, 'He who comes after me has surpassed me, because He was before me.' From the fullness of His grace, we have all received one blessing after another. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, but God, the one and only, who is at the Father's side, has made Him known."
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
An incredible passage that speaks about the Logos, the Word that becomes flesh. A number of wonderful articles have pointed out the connections in Hellenistic literature with Philo and others in connecting Logos theology, Justin Martyr as well, with the Devar, with the Word, with the Torah even. And also, more recently, in even connecting rabbinic literature in some ways, one of the most striking connections is to see that Or, or light, is a way of talking about the Torah. And this is commonly seen in the Hebrew phrase Deoraita. It took me many years to realize what that meant. The Deoraita is the Aramaic of Or. Or is light, yes, and that means from the law, from the Torah. And not De Rabbanan, which is from the rabbis. So here we have a very common phrase used in everyday parlance in Hebrew to express how this is coming from the, what? Deoraita, from the Torah. So what's the word used? Or. So we have a nice rabbinic connection as well that has been unpacked by Serge Ruzer a little bit recently. But the overall beginning here I want to make is that Logos and Devar, the Word in Greek, the Word in Hebrew, can nicely be connected through Hellenistic Judaism. And even gone further with the help of maybe early, I don't know, but at least heuristically suggestive comparison between the light that's mentioned here. That's a theme in John, right? Light and darkness, receiving the light, walking in the light, and Yeshua as He comes to tabernacle. We're talking today about the humble God-man as light of the world. And we're going to be bringing in a number of different themes related to that. But one of them is the God-man, Yeshua, right, who comes in flesh here in John 1. This is not quite as typical as reading the nativity stories, right, in Matthew and Luke for this Christmas-tide season. But I thought it was appropriate because John not only brings Yeshua into the flesh, but also has this major theme of light. And that's evident throughout the book of John and the epistles as well. And we're going to capture a little bit of that as we talk about more broadly about Yeshua as an incarnate person, God incarnate, how he was infleshed, and what that means for us today. So, what are some of the things that may come to mind when you think of Jesus as a Jew and being enfleshed? What are some tangible things that might strike you as new or fresh or exemplary of Yeshua coming in the flesh? This is a very broad question, so we'll see if it works, but when you think of Jesus coming in the flesh as a Jew, what does that mean? Yeah?
I think you already
okay, what's that?
Humble.
Homer?
Humble.
Humble, yes, you know, yes.
I discovered very recently on me the dimension of certain dimensions, the reality of humility. God is terribly humble, amazingly humble,
right.
And he needs us. He wants to lead us, and of course Jesus was amazingly humble, and he says so. And what is very strange is that there is a verse repeating all the time, come to me because you have a problem, because I am humble. We just forgot the humble thing.
Yes, humility is a sub-theme of what we'll be speaking about today. Thank you for that. Some of the texts that are often, more recently, brought out for showing Yeshua or God's humility is sticking Mary and Joseph, you know, and not in a guest room, not in an inn, right? But in a more humble abode, a place where animals and such, right? So this is pretty humble.
I'm looking back to verse 18, no one has ever seen God. Kind of sounds like a contradiction. Okay, Jesus is God. Okay, Jesus is in the flesh. Okay, let's learn what that means if Jesus did come in the flesh.
Yeah, this is a great mystery. The incarnation and the nature of God.
I heard a wonderful story about Mephisteret.
Mm-hmm.
When I can't remember how it is, but it used to be Mephisteret, the name of Mephisteret, God's name, because when they came around the corner, they could see Jerusalem,
mm-hmm.
and so they could see Zion.
Mm-hmm.
and what I heard is when Mary went to, isn't it Elizabeth that lived there?
Yeah, in
Ghana.
And so she went and met Sarah. Sarah meaning
glad tidings.
Pardon?
Good tidings. Glad news.
Good tidings,
yeah.
But it has the same root as Basar.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
that
maybe.
And he said, "This is this is where you really see in Christianity the incarnation within the Hebrew, Meva, good tidings, but also good tidings of God coming down, Bashar, the same root."
It's definitely a wonderful midrashic reading. You know, whether how tight it is, I don't know. I have to explore further, but Jewish exegetical way is stacks on top in a wonderful way, which I think is very in line with our New Testament and our early patristic evidence. So Medeser is related to Besar.
So there's a connotation that when they would come in to see Zion, and it's the glad tidings, when you turn the corner, you're going to see Zion, glad tidings. Mm-hmm. You're going to see God come in the flesh, and then you see Basar, and you see God came in the flesh. Interesting, huh?
Yeah, sometimes words sound the same and aren't necessarily related to the same meanings, but here we have a beautiful collision, I would say, of meanings in good tidings and flesh, the soul. So humility, connections between good news and God as man, and some of these relate to Jewishness, right? I was thinking of what it means for God to become a Jew. Some are more general. That's good too.
We haven't hit what you wanted to hit.
Well, this is good. This is very good. I'm moving in directions of humility. We're talking about flesh, and talking about the nature of Yeshua and God. So all of these relate to where we're going.
Also, identity to a special people.
Right. Yeah.
They were supposed to be the kingdom of priests. That was what was said. You will be a kingdom of priests, written in the Torah. Mm-hmm. And it was also, because of that identity with a special people, a sanctification, a setting apart of a special people. So.
Right.
You want to say next to God?
Well, maybe. But I'm thinking about a person coming in flesh, and what are some tangible evidence markers?
Circumcision?
Yeah, this is one I'm thinking of.
Circumcision?
Oh, okay.
And this relates to flesh. It also relates to humility. It should be a sign of a distinctive people, but it also is meant to recall what the prophets hammer a little harder of circumcision of the heart. Right, this is Deuteronomy, Jeremiah, and such. But we have this humility, this softness, to be open to God, not to be callous, not to be hardened. Right, and so this is something very tangible. Some of you may remember from years past. I've thoroughly enjoyed this insight from the Catholic theology that points out that Jesus' first shedding of the blood is in his circumcision, which is done in Bethlehem. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's a foreshadowing of Yeshua's ultimate sacrifice on the cross, right? Shedding of blood. We remember from Revelation that in a cosmic sense, which will boggle all of our minds, yes, he was already sacrificed before the foundation of the world, it seems, according to Revelation 13:8, if I'm not mistaken. And so we have this dynamic of cosmic and in history, in life, and so this weaving of circumcision and sacrifice that is very suggestive, I guess, a sort of foreshadowing the future. So circumcision is one of the tangible things I was thinking of, and maybe the most, we could go in other directions, but this is one I was thinking of most, that really stamps Yeshua as a Jew, right? The Catholic theology even goes further and says the kingdom of God began on the eighth day of his life. Why is that? Or the inaugural phase, in a sense. Why?
He was circumcised on the
He was circumcised, but that made him a Jew. Not alive, he was alive, but made him a Jew. He wouldn't be able to be Messiah of Israel if he wasn't a Jew, right? And so,
but why can you explain that if he wasn't a Jew by birth, no amount of circumcision, it doesn't matter if you're circumcised. You know what I mean?
Right. Now, there's an element that this is a seal, a stamping, an affirmation,
yeah.
Right? Paul says, "We by nature who are Jews." In Corinthians. So we have this element of nature, What does it mean to be by nature a Jew? You could become a Jew, right? We do have converts.
Mm-hmm.
And we have clarifications in another way, like Titus or Timothy, in different
ways. And we probably get to Romans 2, a Jew who's one of circumcised in his heart.
Right, a spiritual Jew.
And then you use the base of office yesterday.
Yeah, but interesting.
Did not.
But interesting. Robert Lindsay did.
Robert Lindsay.
Yeah.
So, a different time.
So, we're not. I don't. These are nice thoughts of who is a Jew and nature of Jew and such. Those are very important elements of a greater discussion. I'd like to focus mainly on Yeshua and Jesus as a Jew and what it means and how he became a Jew. He was birthed first of all to a Jewish mother, a Jewish father, or not, right? Or had a father who was Jewish. So this, and interestingly, the first century is right on that watershed of switching from the male to the female as far as progeny and lineage, right? Prior to the first century AD, it was male, first century after female.
I'll say present day, everybody in America think, where did the Jews go to church at? They don't think of synagogue. Everything was synagogue and Jewish, and that's what it was. That Mary was the first Catholic and Jesus was the first.
Well, this does relate
to.
We could say that. That's not so much in the flesh, but
right.
It's a tangible example of Jesus, Yeshua, going to the synagogue as was his custom. Right? It says, and Paul also, as was his custom, after he had become apostle to the Gentiles, right? It was still, as was his custom, went to the synagogue. So a synagogue is a marker in a sense of a Jewish life, although not limited to. We know, according to Josephus, Philo, many, many non-Jews were attracted to Judaism, right? So, but as a whole, the synagogue tends to be a marker of Jewish faith, and this is Jesus growing up or frequenting the synagogue would be an element of Jewishness.
Judaism is also on the cusp of becoming much, much less evangelistic too,
right,
at that era.
Yeah.
It's still there's still a notion of a lot more openness to to convincing people that, yeah, why don't you join us?
There's an attempt in the scholarly world to push that back earlier and to make Matthew anachronistic and you make apostolate and such, but it seems to me that you were right, Danny, in saying that this first century is still an evangelistic type of light to the Gentiles through whether it's proselytization or pre-Noahide type of laws or visions of what non-Jews are to be. That seems to be stamped out in the second century, significantly after the first Great Revolt, and then the Bar Kokhba Revolt of 135. I think these events, along with the explosion of Christianity among the Gentiles, these forces began to shut down Judaism as an evangelizing religion. I think we see that, interestingly enough, also within the Orthodox churches. In a different way.
And within the Catholic too, a little bit more.
Maybe not as much, I would say, but in Orthodox.
There was it.
Under Islamic, but I'm going too far afield. I'm just running with these wonderful comments. I want to get back to what in practice and palpable sort of shows Jesus is a Jew. And the main point I want to hear make is circumcision and him coming into the flesh. Chapter 1 is a cosmic context, right? He's coming into the world. He's coming into his own, which is often understood as Jewish people. That understanding is problematic, I think. His own, it's, I think, verse 11, if we look. Really, it's a domain, possession. I suggest humanity. The context is coming into the world. It's cosmic. Later on in John chapter 3, We have the light coming into darkness. The darkness rejects it, right? So we have, he's coming into the world. Let's look real quick at John chapter 3. But it's not only 3. It's many places in 1 John as well, how he comes into the world. The world doesn't know him. He is light, and the darkness does not accept the light. Does anybody see that? 3:19 or 3? Yeah, the light has come into the world, and men, people, love the darkness rather than the light. So we have this light coming in, and something rejecting it. Often this is understood as the Jewish people. These verses like this, and I would hesitate to show, to suggest that, you know, we have a grander vision here of just the Jewish people. This is humanity in general. This is enfleshed in flesh. It is Jewish flesh, right? But he's coming into the world also for humanity, and the vision is greater than just Jews. So people that are rejecting Yeshua here in verse 11, right? It is the world. It's the parallels that we see in 1 John. It's the parallel that we see in John 3:19, I think. And it should be taken as a communication. Oh, here it is. The Jews rejected Jesus. It's really us. It's humanity.
I was going to say, Gary, like, I think it was a couple weeks ago when he taught about, he just pointed out how in John it says Jesus came to save the world from their sins. Mm. Whereas in Matthew and Luke it says to save, like, his own people or whatever. Mm. So it just shows again that John maybe does have this bigger...
Right. And Matthew is the lost sheep of Israel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So connecting to what you're saying, yeah.
Thank you. So... yes, okay.
I think that... I don't know if I'm able to be here, but I feel like you're the Jews, and I think I can speak so because I'm a Jew myself, but I feel like, you know, some lots of people in literature, they say that when they write a novel, it's easier to make people to pass an idea than when they have a philosophical idea. They say that it's people are going to understand better. It is a novel. And then for me now, I feel like maybe I go a little bit too far, but it's just the idea that in the Bible, God took the Jews. Also, just to give an example for people to say that to God wanted also to expect that God has a personal law. It's not like a regular law, you know? And then, right. And then I think that the fact of Jewishness or not Jewishness, I don't think that it is that important, that much important, because there are lots of people who are very good people, dumb Jews.
Yep. Yep.
And
so
then I think that it's important to realize that God really came for the world.
That's
came
right.
For the Jews, came for the world.
That's very true, and we see that in Peter's vision, and, you know, hit on his head 3 times, he couldn't get over that God's vision was the Gentiles as well. And so he finally, for this vision in Acts 10, he finally gets it. That God is the God of Israel and the nations. And if he was only the God of Israel, then everybody would need to become an Israelite. But that's not the case. He's the God of Israel and the nations. Right. Let's continue on. I want to cover a lot of ground, and so I want to keep moving, and maybe I'll talk more now. Okay, so in John chapter 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, we see a number of feasts that are Advent, and some of you may remember from 4 years ago when I shared on the same theme. I don't know if that's the case, but we don't have clear chronological markers in all of these passages. In John chapter 7, it's clear that we're talking about Sukkot, right? It says that in verse 2. But in 8, 9, 10, we don't have a clear delineation. And there's been a good article by John Fourier, who's talked about Hanukkah, and argued, I think, very convincingly, that we should reconsider the Sukkot narrative, or the tabernacles, which is typically 7, 8, 9, and then we get to Hanukkah and 10. You can see that in the calendar, right? Sukkot is in the fall, Hanukkah is in the winter, right? we should actually back Hanukkah up within the narrative, within John. And it's not just chapter 10 when Jesus is in Solomon's porticos, right? Likely celebrating, it seems, he's in Solomon's porticos, the place that's named after the builder of the temple. Not saying anything negative, suggestive. We should back that up even though from John 10 and get back into 9 and 8. And even... No, 8. Yes, and 8. So from 7:39, we have the end of Sukkot. We have this interim period where he's... it's not clear, but then he's in the temple, right, in chapter 8. And it seems that this is a transition that's not marked by the gospel writer, but the themes and the connections are incredibly rich, right? Does anybody remember this from 4 years ago? Okay. So we can move on. So we can move, I guess. Just glancing quickly at 8, 9, 10. What are some of the themes that pop up to you? I'm the light of the world. Right. What else? So we have a theme of light throughout. Not one time, multiple times. What are some other examples of light? We can go that direction as well. Maybe it's too...
Are you in the first chapter of John?
John chapter 8, 9, 10.
John chapter 8.
John chapter 8, John chapter 9, John chapter 10.
Testimony, the shepherd.
Yeah, so okay, for an interest of time, let me just, keep going.
Yeah.
So we have Jesus is the light of the world, which you just mentioned. We also have Jesus healing the man who is blind, and he brings light to him in a very tangible sort of way, right?
Yeah.
We also have in chapter 8 a theme that's very basic to Hanukkah, which is freedom, right? The truth shall make you free, right? And this idea of freedom is significant. We also, maybe this is the most subtle and the most powerful, is that it's in Hanukkah time period, according to this argument, that Jesus reveals his deity, or that he is one with the Father, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a most subtle, time to do, and powerful, poignant time to do this. Why? What is Hanukkah based upon? It's an overcoming of the person who called himself God revealed, right? And we see links in this chapter 10. We see, and many said about Jesus, this is 10:19-20, he had a demon in his insane. Well, this is Manitai, which is Antiochus. Antiochus is known as being a maniac, with the same root there in Greek. So this is a... Are they kind of remembering Antiochus? It's possible. It seems suggestive. We also have... this idea throughout kind of 35 through 41 of chapter 9, well, I and the Father are one, right? If you were blind, you would have no sin. Okay, where is it? Received with my Father. Here it is, verse 15. Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. We have other parts as well that connect Yeshua. Here it is also in 10:30, I and the Father are one. So we have the end of chapter 9 and 10 sort of revealing Yeshua's equality, or because he says, equality or oneness, we could say. This is the oneness with the Father. Yeah, and striking that he does that at Hanukkah when Antiochus himself stamps coins, right, which says King Antiochus, God revealed. And so this is, I think, striking to note all this. So this, we have a complex, I think, of themes from John 8, 9, and 10 that relate to Hanukkah, that relate to the dedication. And this desire for plainness, this desire. Who are you? Who are you really? This is verse 24. If you are the Christ, tell us plainly. Well, this also connects with Antiochus being overt and not being subtle about it. So they want to know, you know, are you the person? And Jesus basically says, it's not Antiochus. Okay, I'm going beyond the text, right? It's not Antiochus, it's me. And so that, I think, is suggested. But I don't want to limit ourselves to John. I wanted to also speak about something that sort of affirms the Hanukkah record, and then to think about what it means for Jesus as a Jew today. So two more parts. Maybe we can try to wrap up in a few extra minutes beyond. I think we're supposed to finish about now. We can just take a few extra minutes. The other service starts at 10:45, right?
Yeah.
I think so. We'll take it. Yeah, that's okay. So one of the more exciting archaeological discoveries the past 10 years has been a stele, a stone, that's in the Israel Museum called the Heliodorus stele, which has, I think, about 10 parts. Maybe 5 of them or so were found in archaeological excavation, and the other 3 or 4 or 5 pieces were found in antiquity dealer shops. Have you heard of the Heliodorus stele? Anybody? Nobody?
Say
the
word again.
Heliodorus. Everybody say Heliodorus. There's 2 O's at the end. So it's in 2 Maccabees chapter 3. And this inscription, in the past 10 years, has really affirmed, I guess, the existence of Heliodorus, who was a commander or underling to Antiochus the IV, who was the brother. Antiochus III, who's the brother of Antiochus IV, who's Antiochus Epiphanes, right? Mm-hmm. So a very close connection.
Brian, sorry.
Okay.
It's not Antiochus, it's me. I'm sorry, I just didn't understand.
Okay.
Maybe that's...
I'm maybe speaking too quietly and too quickly. I'm trying to... Okay, so Antiochus...
But we have 10 minutes.
Antiochus Epiphanes... is the main character in the main Seleucid Greek character in Hanukkah story, right? If we had time, we could read from 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees and hear his virulent critiques and commands to shut down Jewishness. No circumcision. That's the point I wanted to emphasize. No Torah, no Sabbath, right? The reading of Torah. So very strong commandments, right? Which, if they would have been successful, would have discontinued the existence of the Jewish people in a real way. So Hanukkah is incredibly significant for even affirming Yeshua and incarnation and circumcision, which stamped him as Jewish. Yeah. Okay. And so Antiochus Epiphanes the IV is the person who made these decrees. And first, there's 2 letters. Yeah, okay, I won't go into it. In 1 and 2 Maccabees, that clearly state this. His brother was the king just prior to him. These are Seleucid kings, you call them rulers, that are after Alexander the Great, and they're vying for Syria. This is known as Syria, or close Syria at the time. And that's even listed in the inscription that was just published. And there's 3 different inscriptions that relate to this time period, 198, 178, 163. So just fascinating to see how they affirm the similar vision of having a king empower a underling, a strategos or something, a significant viceroy, in sending him on a mission. And this mission that's hauntingly or tantalizingly sparse in this inscription tells us just enough to connect it with the act in 2 Maccabees chapter 3. And I will summarize because of time. But I would highly recommend you check out 2 Maccabees chapter 3 and 2 Maccabees chapter 4. for reading for pleasure and relating to this Hanukkah season, because this is probably the most dramatic archaeological find that's been connected to Hanukkah in the past 10 years. So we have the most recent study. Half of it was on the Antiquities Market. It was published. And then lo and behold, other pieces were found that fit what was already sold on the market. And so the thing that was on the market was seen to be authentic. And it was proved to be authentic, or it was argued to be authentic. Already before, they found the other pieces in Marisha. So this is the inscriptions from Marisha, or Beit Ruvrin. I mean, actually two different places, but it's in the Marisha area. It's room 47. For this inscription, pieces were found that link up and mention Heliodorus being sent. And I'll just read a few of the key phrases. Being sent from Damascus, from Syria, right, to this area of Kol Syria, Phoenicia, to make sure that the temples of the gods are respected, right? Meaning the foreign entities, the pagan gods would be, or the polytheistic gods would be given due credit, due honor, and not just the Jewish God, right, there in Jerusalem. So King Seleucus IV, to Heliodorus, his brother, greetings. And I'm going to skip. It says, taking the utmost consideration for the safety of our subjects, and thinking it to be the greatest good of the affairs in our realm. So these are letters that are placed on a stone that make it like a rule or a commandment. It's very fascinating to think about the nature of an epistle, one of the words used, and the nature of it as a commandment, kind of. And so it becomes like a law. Safety of our subjects and thinking it to be the greatest good for the affairs of our realm, when those living in our kingdom manage their lives without fear, and at the same time realizing that nothing can enjoy its fitting prosperity without the goodwill of the gods. So looking after the interests of the gods, really, on our realm. From the outset, we have made it our concern to ensure that the sanctuary is found in other satrapies, other regions, receive the traditional honors with the care befitting them. Right? Well, but since the affairs in Kole, all Syria and Phoenicia, stand in need of appointing someone to take care of these sanctuaries, Olympiodoros, another version of Heliodorus, but Olympiodoros, should be sent. So we have a name, we have that he's supposed to take care of things, and it gives him the clout in which to go and do. Well, if we read 2 Maccabees 3 and 4, we see that Simon has leaked it to the people in Syria that there's a bunch of money that's in the temple that doesn't really belong to the sacrifices. It's kind of extra money, and extra money actually belongs to who? The king. So the king should rightfully come and claim his money's in the temple, which then he says, this is a great idea, I've got to pay off my debts. So he sends Heliodorus to go collect what's rightly his, because it's money that are not really the sacrifices. He does that. What happens?
The sacrifice is the actual physical sacrifice.
Right,
that is really the only thing that belongs to the temple, plus the menorah or something like that.
Right.
Or even not the menorah.
No. Well, I don't. I should. All those cultic things and the money related to the sacrifices belong to the temple itself, whereas any money that's collected beyond that is really belonging to the king. Right, and so we have, and he knows about this because Simon is disenfranchised with Onias, the third, another priest. He's in bad relationship with the temple priests. He wants to get back at them by letting the powers that be in Syria know that there's money, and so that the priest that he is brokest with, at loggerheads with, will pay. Right, so Heliodorus comes. And there's this dramatic, angelic, miraculous event that takes place where Heliodorus sees a horse and two what seem to be angels and blocks him, and he's hurt and wounded, and he is thwarted from taking that. In the end, prays to God, and that's very dramatic, prays to, this be healing, and he ends up sacrificing, for example. So it's a very
And this is in Maccabees.
This is in 2 Maccabees 3 and 4. The point is that these this stele, and these pieces that were just discovered since 2005 through 2007 are a dramatic connection and a very tight historical archaeological piece to this fellow. But I have more to say, but we have to wrap up. I just want to close with this. Is Yeshua the light of the world today? Yes. Amen? Anybody? Okay, you
heard that?
Testify? Yeah, okay. So if he is, then what does that mean for us today as Jesus the Jew? He says he's coming back in the same way. He's coming back as Messiah, right? The Messiah of Israel has to be Jewish. Mm-hmm. He's also the lineage of David. The last verse is in the New Testament. We should close with this. Revelation chapter 20, the last few verses in the New Testament. Revelation chapter 21, right, is it? It's 22 real short though, right?
Yes.
So let's do, I think it's 21:16 if I'm remembering. Let's just look at how Jesus describes himself here at the end of days. 21:16.
Verse 16.
Yeah.
I am the root and the offspring of David.
Yep. What verse is that?
22:16.
22:16. And the Spirit, I, Yeshua, have sent my angel to testify to you these things for the churches. I am, present tense, the root and the offspring of David, the bright morning star. Jesus, Yeshua, seems to be coming back, not generically, but as a circumcised Jew. As a Jew, right? In bodily function, after the resurrection scene, right? And that is incredibly jarring, maybe, but suggestive for more theological reflection for our life today. Amen.